Mark, who gave us such a memorable phrase as he let his emotions burst forth, was not described by Lewis. It is through Lewis's eyes and words that we see the White Cliffs, the Great Falls before the dams, the Gates of the Mountains, Three Forks, the Shoshones. Wonderful portraits all. Vivid, immediate, detailed. They set the standard. But we don't have his description of what he saw and how he felt in this moment of triumph. Clark had been a bit premature. What he had seen was the Columbian estuary, not the ocean. Actually, they were too close to the ocean for their own good anyway. For the next week and more, they were pinned down by the tide, the waves, the wind at Point Ellis. They were unable to go forward, to retreat, to climb out of their campsite because of the overhanging rocks and hills, to do anything except endure pure misery. It rained for 11 days. At high tide, gigantic waterborne trees of cedar, fir, and spruce, some of them almost 200 feet long and up to 7 feet in diameter, crashed into the camp. Fires were hard to start, difficult to maintain. The captains and men of the expedition looked more like survivors from a shipwreck praying for rescue than the triumphant members of the Corps of Discovery. For a while, spirits remained high. For several days past, Clark wrote on the 9th, notwithstanding the disagreeable time of the party, they are all cheerful. But it didn't last. Never one to suffer silently, Clark wrote on November 12th, it would be distressing to a feeling person to see our situation at this time, all wet and cold with our bedding, etc., also wet, in a cove scarcely large enough to contain us, canoes at the mercy of the waves and driftwood, robes and leather clothes are rotten. November 22nd. The wind increased to a storm, blew with violence, throwing the water of the river with immense waves out of its banks, almost overwhelming us in water. Oh, how horrible is the day! November 27th. The wind blew with such violence that I expected every moment to see trees taken up by the roots. Some were. Oh, how tremendous is the day! Since May 1804, the expedition had stopped only for winter, or because the captains decided to take a couple of days' rest. They hated being immobilized by a force they could not fight. They had to be rescued by Clatsop Indians, the Chinookan people living on the south bank of the estuary, who were able to cross the estuary easily in their coastal canoes, in conditions that absolutely defeated every effort the Americans made to get out of their bad spot. The Clatsop saved them by selling roots and fish. On November 13th, the desperate captains sent Privates Coulter, Willard, and Shannon in the Indian canoe, which rode the swells better, to explore the shoreline beyond Point Ellis to see if a better campsite could be found. The next day, Coulter returned by land to report that there was a sandy beach in the bay beyond the point and away inland from it, and game in the area. The captains agreed that Lewis would lead an advance party to the site, while Clark arranged to move the entire camp as soon as the weather permitted. The following afternoon, Lewis took advantage of a head-on wind to have 5 men take himself, Driard, and 3 privates around the point. The paddlers put Lewis and his party ashore on the beach and returned to the main camp, their canoe nearly swamped by the following waves breaking over it. Finally, the impatient Lewis could do some exploring at the mouth of the river. He had a specific and immediate goal. He wanted to see if there really were some white men living on the coast. If so, and if he could find their trading post, he figured to be able to use Jefferson's letter of credit to provide the expedition with ample trading goods for the return trip, and start a copy of the journals to Washington via a visiting sea captain. And, of course, he wanted to see the ocean. When he set out in the morning, he found Privates Shannon and Willard in a precarious position. After separating from Coulter, they had gone hunting and exploring. They had spent the night with 5 Chinooks, members of the tribe living on the north bank. While they slept, the Indians stole their rifles. In the morning, discovering the theft, they informed the Indians with crude but emphatic signs that a larger party of white men was about to join them and would surely shoot the thieves. At that moment, Lewis and his small party appeared on the scene. His presence, and perhaps some threatening motions, convinced the thieves to repent. They handed back the rifles. Lewis sent Shannon back to the sandy beach, which he correctly surmised Clark would have reached by now. The chastised Indians went with Shannon, virtual prisoners. When Clark heard Shannon's story, he exploded. "I told these Indians they should not come near us, and if any one of their nation stole anything from us, I would have him shot," which they understood very well. "And if any of their women or bad boys took anything, to return it immediately and chastise them for it." Lewis, meanwhile, continued his exploration, rounding Cape Disappointment and going up the coastline for several miles. No trading post, no ship. He kept no journal. But he did carve his name into a tree at the extremity of Cape Disappointment with a certain sense of pride. Enough, anyway, to tell Captain Clark later that he had recorded his presence. At 1:30 p.m. on November 17th, Lewis joined Clark at the camp on the sandy beach that the party would occupy for the next week, in present-day Fort Canby State Park, near Mackenzie Head. It was a much superior campsite, and the hunters could get out and bring in some meat. On November 18th, it was Clark's turn to ramble. He set out with York and 10 men on a reconnaissance to Cape Disappointment, where he found Lewis's name carved in the tree. Together with the men, Clark followed Lewis's example, but greatly improved on it by adding to his name and the date the magnificent line, "By land from the United States in 1804 and 1805. On his return from his reconnaissance, Clark found Lewis with a group of Chinooks, including 2 chiefs. They all sat for a smoke. The captains handed medals and an American flag to the chiefs. Some trading was done. One of the chiefs had on a robe made of sea otter skins that Clark declared, "more beautiful than any fur I had ever seen." Lewis agreed. In his turn, each captain tried to strike a bargain for the robe, offering different articles. "No," said the chief. He pointed at Sacagawea's belt of blue beads, the most highly prized beads of all. The captains looked at her questioningly. She made it clear that if she had to turn over the belt, she wanted something in return. One of the captains brought her a coat of blue cloth, and she handed over the belt. Clark's journal fails to say who ended up with the fur coat, but it surely wasn't Sacagawea. The next day, an old Chinook woman appeared with 6 of her daughters and nieces in tow. She was selling their favors. Clark remarked, "Those people appear to view sensuality as a necessary evil. The young females are fond of the attention of our men." At this, their westernmost campsite, the captains again felt the urge to mark their presence. Lewis used his branding iron to mark a tree. Clark and all the men carved their names into the surrounding trees. Meanwhile, the word had gotten out among the Clatsops that the captains would pay almost any price for sea otter furs. That night, a group came over the estuary with 2 robes to sell. The captains wanted them, but the price was too high. Clark was astonished when one owner turned down the offer of a watch, a handkerchief, a bunch of red beads, and $1 in American coin. The Indians wanted blue beads, and the captains were all but out of them. Still, the captains found they liked the Clatsops much better than their relatives, the Chinooks, mainly because the Clatsops were not thieves. That became a factor in the decision that now had to be made: where to spend the winter. The obvious requirements were good water, plenty of game, and some shelter. They had 3 choices: to stay where they were, to cross to the south bank to see if there was a better site there, or to go back upstream to the falls. The Clatsops informed them that elk were plentiful on the south side. The captains were certain that their supply of beads and trinkets was so inadequate, and the Chinooks' prices were so high, that they could not get through the winter buying their food. They needed a continuing source of meat. Lewis said that upriver the winter would be more severe, and this location would not really help them get started on the homeward voyage. They would have to wait for the snow to melt in the Bitterroots anyway, so there was plenty of time to go back up the Columbia Snake in the spring. He wanted to get closer to the ocean, which was easier done on the south side, so that he could put men to making salt from the seawater. He and all the men craved salt. Not Clark. He heartily disapproved, writing that he was indifferent to whether or not he had salt. Anyway, "salt water I view as an evil inasmuch as it is not healthy." Lewis had a better reason than his taste buds for wanting to stay near the coast. There was at least a good chance that a trading vessel would arrive during the winter. If one did, it would solve major supply problems. Clark agreed. He also pointed out that with elk more abundant on the south shore and deer on the north, the choice was easy. Elk were bigger and easier to kill, and their skins were better for clothing. So the captains made up their own minds, but on this occasion they decided to let everyone participate in the decision. They put it to a vote. They never explained why. Perhaps they felt that since they were all going to be in this together, they should all have a say. Maybe they just wanted to involve everyone so that none would have a right to complain. The choices were to stay, to proceed to the falls, or to cross to and examine the other side before deciding. Naturally, the third alternative won, overwhelmingly. Only Private John Shields voted against it. If the sites on the south side were unsatisfactory, about half the voters wanted to go up to the falls, half to stay at the mouth. York's vote was counted and recorded. Using Sacagawea's nickname, Clark noted, "Janey in favor of a place where there is plenty of potas." Apparently, she meant roots. This was the first vote ever held in the Pacific Northwest. It was the first time in American history that a black slave had voted, the first time a woman had voted. On November 26, after going upriver for 2 days to find a shorter crossing, the party crossed to the south shore. They camped on the east bank of the John Day River and were again pinned down by bad weather. By the 29th, Lewis had had enough. He told Clark he would take their Indian canoe and Round Tongue Point to examine the country where the Clatsop said there were elk. He handpicked the men he wanted with him. Driard, of course, along with Privates Reuben Field, Shannon, Coulter, and Labiche. They set out early in the morning, got around the point, and made camp that night near the site of present-day Astoria, Oregon. Lewis sent out the hunters. They returned with 4 deer and some geese and ducks, a haul as encouraging as it was welcome. Lewis made a short journal entry, providing a bare outline of his activities, as he would do the next 2 days as well. Clark wrote on the last page of Lewis's writings, "Captain Lewis Ruff notes when he left Captain Clark near the mouth of Columbia for a few days to examine the southwest side." Lewis set out at sunrise to explore Young's Bay, so named by Lieutenant Broughton of Vancouver's expedition. Finding nothing satisfactory at the outlet of Young's River, he went up today's Lewis and Clark River about a mile and was discouraged. Lewis returned to the bay, hoping to find some Clatsops, who have tantalized us with there being much game in their neighborhood, to ask them where that game was. All about him, they might have answered. There were great numbers of brants, geese, sandhill cranes, and blue herons, and a large variety and immense number of ducks in the bay. But of course Lewis wanted elk. In his field notes that night, he recorded botanical data. Over the next couple of days, he explored, this time going farther up the Lewis and Clark River, where he found his spot. He told Clark it was on a small bluff rising some 30 feet higher than the high tide mark, some 200 feet back from the river and about 3 miles up from its mouth. It was near a spring, and there were plenty of big trees that could be used to make shelter and a fort. It was but a few miles to the open ocean where salt could be made. Best of all, it promised good hunting. Driard and another hunter had killed 6 elk and 5 deer. Clark reported that this was very satisfactory information to all the party. The expedition made ready to move to its winter quarters as soon as the wind would allow it to round the point to get into the bay and then up the river. On December 6, the wind was too high, but the following morning, Lewis guided the expedition to the site of what the captains would call Fort Clatsop. Clark took one look and pronounced it a most eligible situation. Chapter 25. Fort Clatsop, December 8, 1805 to March 23, 1806. On the morning of December 8, Clark set out to find the best route to the ocean and to find a place for a salt-making camp. Lewis sent out the hunters and put the remainder of the party to work cutting down trees, probably grand fir, to make huts and a palisade. When Clark returned from a successful reconnaissance 3 days later, Lewis was still cutting trees. Not until December 14th did he have enough for the men to start splitting logs. They found that the wood split beautifully, even to the width of 2 feet and more. The first hut they commenced building was a smokehouse. They were finding that the preservation of meat in that rainy climate required extraordinary measures. The work went slowly. It always rained, sometimes worse than others. On December 16th, Clark recorded, "The wind's violent. Trees falling in every direction, whirlwinds with gusts of rain, hail, and thunder. This kind of weather lasted all day. Certainly one of the worst days that ever was." Many of the men were sick or injured. Some had tumors. Private William Werner had a strained knee. Private Joseph Field had biles. Private George Gibson had dysentery. Sergeant Nathaniel Pryor had a dislocated shoulder. York suffered from colic and griping. And the fleas, picked up from the Indians and inescapable, tormented their nights and prevented a sound sleep. Entertaining and trading with visiting Indians took time. On December 12th, the chief of a neighboring Clatsop village named Cobaway paid a visit. The Indians gave him the usual medal and traded for roots. Lewis purchased 2 lynx skins, Clark 2 otter skins. Prices were reasonable one day, outrageous the next. On December 23rd, Clark purchased a panther skin nearly 8 feet long for 6 small fish hooks, a worn-out file, and some spoiled fish. The next day, a young chief named Cascala came with his brother and 2 women. They wanted to sell a parcel of roots but demanded 2 files for them, which the captains decided was too high a price. Cascala then offered a woman to each captain, "which we also declined accepting," Clark wrote, which also displeased them. The female part appeared to be highly disgusted at our refusing of their favors, etc. Despite the daily interruptions, the work went forward. By December 17th, enough of the walls of the huts were up so some of the men could begin filling the chinks between the logs. A week later, they were putting on the roofs. The captains moved into their unfinished hut on December 23rd. The next day, Private Joseph Field made writing tables for them, and the men moved into their as-yet unroofed huts. Fort Clatsop was about 50 feet square. It had 2 long, facing structures joined on the sides by palisaded walls. There was a main gate at the front and a smaller one at the rear that provided easy access to a spring some 30 yards distant. Between the buildings there was a parade ground about 50 feet by 20 feet. One of the structures was divided into 3 rooms, or huts, which served as enlisted men's quarters. The other contained 4 rooms, one for the captains, one for Charbonneau, Sacajawea, and their son Jean-Baptiste, one to serve as an orderly room, and the 4th the smokehouse. At first light on Christmas morning, 1805, the men woke the captains with a volley, a shout, and a song. They exchanged presents. Private Whitehouse gave Captain Clark a pair of moccasins he had made, Private Silas Goodrich gave him a woven basket, Sacajawea gave him 2 dozen white weasel tails, and Captain Lewis gave him a vest, drawers, and socks. The captains divided the small quantity of tobacco they had left, keeping one part for use with the Indians and dividing the other among the men who smoked. The 8 non-smokers each got a handkerchief. The celebration didn't last long. It was a wet and disagreeable day, and as Clark recorded, "We would have spent this day, the Nativity of Christ, in feasting, had we anything either to raise our spirits or even gratify our appetites. Our dinner consisted of poor elk, so much spoiled that we ate it through mere necessity, some spoiled pounded fish and a few roots." 3 days later, the captains decided they could spare a small party of salt makers. The party left for the camp just south of present-day Seaside, Oregon, and went to work. On December 29th, the Clatsops informed the captains that a whale had foundered on the coast near Tillamook Head. Lewis at once determined to go there by water to get some oil and blubber. He prepared a party to take the canoes to fetch it, but for the next week the wind was too high to risk setting out. On December 30th, the fort was completed. At sunset, the captains told the Clatsops that from now on, when darkness fell, the gates would be shut and they must all get out of the fort. "Those people who are very forward and disagreeable," Clark reported, "left the huts with reluctance." But on New Year's Eve, he was happy to record that the Indians were much better behaved. "The sight of our sentinel who walks on his post has made this reform in those people who but yesterday was very impertinent and disagreeable to all." At dawn on New Year's Day, 1806, the man woke the captains with a volley and shouts of, "Happy New Year!" There was no other celebration and no feast. Lewis wrote that, "We were content with eating our boiled elk and wapato roots and solacing our thirst with our only beverage, pure water." During the more than 3 weeks the party had been building Fort Clatsop, Lewis wrote but two field notes, describing in some detail Steller's Jay. But on January 1st, he resumed making daily entries in his journal. He opened with a complaint that the volley fired by the men to usher in the new year was the only mark of respect which we had it in our power to pay this celebrated day. Our repast of this day was no better than that of Christmas. But after the first sentence, he wrote with a zest that seemed to indicate that a great weight had been lifted from him. It was 1806. He would be home this year. A year wasn't such a long time. Evidently, not until he began writing about getting home did Lewis realize how much he missed civilization. He had spent 1801-3 living with Thomas Jefferson in the president's house. His daily conversational fare had ranged from practical politics to the nature of man, from zoology to botany, geography to medicine, literature to history, all in the company of the leading cultural, intellectual, scientific, and political figures in the United States, and not a few from Europe. For 2 years he had danced to the best music, dined at the finest table, drunk the choicest wine. He had spent 1804-5 on the frontier and beyond. His daily conversational fare had been about immediate practical problems, mostly with enlisted men who had little, if any, formal education.